Tommy, we got scammed.
Yeah, this was pretty crazy. So this week we fell for a phishing scam and we genuinely got scammed, but it was a very clever scam.
Yeah, and we're going to talk all about that so that you don't have to get scammed. But before we get to that, since this is an automotive podcast, we've got an interesting list of cars that depreciate quickly and those that don't depreciate.
So our friends over at IC Cars, which is a really powerful analyst firm that looks at vehicle data, compiled a list of the top 25 vehicles with the lowest depreciation and the top 25 vehicles with the most depreciation.
Yeah, and I'm not sure they're powerful, but they're certainly interesting. And so let's start with the top 10 cars that depreciate the least, and then we'll talk about the top 10 that depreciate the most. And let's play a game, okay? So out of these top 10 that we're going to go through, and we're going to go from 10 to 1 in TFL order, we have owned 5 of them. So if you guys are hardcore, hardcore TFL fans, let's see if you can guess the 5 of the 10 that we're about to go over that we've owned, and then at the end we'll tell you. So what is number 10, Tommy?
So number 10 is probably not much of a surprise because a lot of these cars are, things you'd expect to hold their value, but number 10 is the Toyota Corolla hatchback. The average 5-year depreciation for a Corolla hatchback is 30.1% according to IC Cars. That's equivalent to $7,156.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, that is pretty good for basically an economy car. Now, number 9 on the list is the Porsche 718 Boxer. And there are a lot of Porsches on this list. That depreciates 29.6% or $22,155.
Yeah, so, we often think of sports cars as being very quickly depreciating assets. And I think in a lot of cases that's true with vehicles like the Jaguar F-Type, right? But there's actually several sports cars on this list in the top 10 least depreciating. And number 8's a good example of that as well. It's the Ford Mustang. So that depreciates 29.2% in 5 years. That's a $9,000 difference over MSRP. Mustang, an iconic vehicle. And I'll give one away. We've owned multiple Mustangs here. And
we have owned the Mustang. You just gave it away, but that's okay.
Yes, I gave that one away because we've owned like 17 of them. But even like a slightly used Mustang, like we had the 2014, was worth a ton of money. Maybe not so much the V6s, but especially the Coyote V8s really hold their value.
Yeah, and especially the fact that we own a 68 California Special, which at the time when it was new, I'm sure it was like $2,000, and now it's worth like $30,000. So that's a pretty good example of how they don't depreciate.
Well,
I mean, the one thing about
hold on there, sport.
I know, a little bit of inflation in there. I know you were, you had to go there, right? I know if you had invested that in the stock market,
it would be
worth $300 billion now.
It probably would actually.
But you couldn't drive those stocks, could you?
No, but you could buy a lot of things that you could drive.
And those stocks probably wouldn't get you. You know what?
They definitely would. They 100% would.
I don't know about that.
More than a 68 Mustang, that's for sure. So number 7 on the list, Tundra, depreciates 29%. Number 6 is
You know what's interesting about the Tundra?
Yeah.
Even though Toyota's in the process, and I just had word that they're actually starting this process now, it's taken them a while, of replacing 100,000. That's exactly right, 100,000 Tundra engines.
Uh-huh.
They're still on the list of, least depreciating.
You know why that could be though?
Because they're replacing the engines.
No, because that's not this is not the Tundra engine one. So what we're looking at here is 5-year depreciation. So that would be 2020 Tundras, and that was still the V8.
Well, 5-year depreciation. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, so this is still the old Tundra.
So it's the venerable V8.
Yes. So I'm really curious to see in another 5 years, what is the twin turbo Tundra going to do?
Good point, Scout.
So Scout.
Sport.
Sport. So number 6 is the Chevrolet Camaro sports car. Average depreciation 28% or 86.
Imagine if you could see out of it.
Yeah, then it would maybe even do better. $8,600. Number 5, not really a surprise. It's the Corvette. The Civic at 28% depreciation. But number 4 is the Corvette at 27% depreciation in 5 years.
Yep, number 3.
Well, you want to hang on. We should talk about that.
Okay.
This is interesting. Because I just did a video talking about how used C8 Corvettes, which is 2020, right,
yep,
are really good values. But as a grand scheme of things, they don't actually depreciate that quickly compared to a lot of other cars. So you can now get a C8 Corvette for 58 to like 65,
yep.
2020 early one, which seems like a steal when you consider 500 horsepower, 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds, whatever. But really, they don't depreciate that badly.
Well, the thing about the Corvette that people may not recall, especially the C8, is that they were sold – a considerably over sticker when they were new.
Good point.
So I don't think this takes that into account. And I don't think that the C7 was being sold over sticker if this goes back 5 years.
Well, if you look, though, it's the difference based from MSRP, which isn't
over sticker.
Over sticker,
so,
right.
So there would be a greater depreciation if you factored in that a lot of people bought them over sticker.
That's
anyway,
a great point, yeah.
All right, number three, the Toyota Tacoma.
Yeah.
Which is obviously known for its longevity. It is the most popular midsize truck in the U.S. I remember, I think it sells about 250,000 units a year. Mm-hmm. So it does really, really well. That's 26% or $8,217.
Yeah, but if you're trying to pitch your spouse on a vehicle that doesn't depreciate very much, forget the Corolla and the Civic. The Porsche 918 Cayman only depreciates 21.8% in 5 years. And the Porsche 911 is even better, down just 19.5% in 5 years. So there you go. There's a money-saving tip of the day.
Yeah, but the problem is the way you say that, Tommy, is it depreciates only 19%, but that 19%...
Yeah, it is $24,000.
It's $24,000, yeah.
Yeah.
So out of the 10, which five have we owned?
So we had a
we still have a Mustang. We've had the current generation GT. We've also owned the Tacoma. Last year we bought that. We have a current Corvette. We also own a 911 that we sold, and we bought it for the same amount that we sold it for. So after a year, it depreciated exactly zero if you don't count taxes. And anything else I'm missing there? Are those a five?
We did have a Boxster.
We did have a Boxster
as
well.
That's number nine, yeah. So, yeah, pretty good. But you're also going to find we also owned five cars on the top 10 most appreciating list.
Oh, my God.
But if we look, let's take a look at the least appreciating.
Yep.
As a 25 list, you can go over to IC Cars and see the whole thing. But there's a lot of stuff that you'd expect, like the Camry, 35%, the Wrangler, 33.9%. The Impreza, the Corolla, the 4Runner, the RAV4, they're all on this list. But that was just the top 10 that we focused on. So if we look at the top five vehicles with the highest depreciation, number 10 on that list is the Cadillac Escalade ESV, which interesting because Escalades are a vehicle that in my mind are always really in demand. But apparently over 5 years, they lose 62.9% of their value.
I would think the smart money would be on the Yukon or the Tahoe and not the Escalade.
Yeah, could be.
And we have owned an Escalade, so we have owned that car as well. I just think Escalades are you're paying for the name and you're paying for the brand, but you're getting the exact same thing basically in either a Suburban Tahoe or Yukon. So the smart money, I think, would get one of those three cars, unless you really want the blinginess of the Escalade.
So another car that's lost a ton of money in the past 5 years, the Tesla Model X, right?
Yeah, that one wasn't a grand slam for Tesla. It had those darn Falcon wing doors, right?
Yep.
Which were problematic to develop, and I don't think people actually felt that car, because those doors feel like they should be on a sports car, but they're really on a potential 7-seat family hauler. So it seems like it's a weird mix of what should be sporty versus what should be a family hauler, and the two just don't seem to go together, even though we own that car too.
They got to guess. Remember, it's a game.
Oh,
yeah.
We're guessing again. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's keep guessing. Okay.
Number eight is the Maserati Levante, losing a whopping 63.7%. This is a car that I think sold well for Maserati, but was ultimately kind of is now viewed as a little bit of a miss because it has a lot of like Chrysler and cheap FCA Stellantis switchgear in it. It just isn't that special, but it was very expensive.
So Porsche did this thing and then everybody copied him, right? So Porsche was down and out, and then they built the Boxster, and that saved them, and then they built on that success and basically came out with the Cayenne. So they were the first sports car brand to actually go into building family hauling crossovers or SUVs. And then all the other manufacturers saw what Porsche had done, and they were like, hey, we could do really well with that by taking the sports car brand and, you know, putting a family hauler in your garage next to the sports car in your garage. And that has not worked, I would say, for majority of the brands that have tried that. And that includes Maserati. The other brand where it did work was Lamborghini. I think the Urus actually accounts for like, I was listening to an interview with the CEO of Lamborghini, and they sold about 10,000 cars last year, and about half of those were Uruses.
I hate to say it, but I think it works for everybody that tries it.
No, no.
It works for Mercedes with the ML. Huge successful.
No, Mercedes, you have to take a sports car brand.
Yeah, but
Mercedes wasn't a sports car brand. So let me give you the brands that did that where I don't think it worked.
Maserati, it worked because they sold a ton of them.
I don't think it worked.
And if you look at it from a monetary standpoint, they made a lot of money on Levantes. I would say BMW, I know, maybe not a sports car brand.
No, you got to stick with sports car brands.
But it worked for the X5.
So let's don't stick, okay. stick with sports
Alfa
car brands.
Alfa Romeo. Historically a sports car brand.
They also built sedans.
Yes, but it works really, really well for the what was that thing called? The oh my god, Alfa Romeo.
The Tonale?
No, what's the oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's how well it worked. You can't remember the name of the car.
The Stelvio. Gosh, my brain is not working. But Stelvio, they sold a lot of as well.
Once again, not a pure sports car brand. Let me give you another pure sports car brand. Aston Martin. I don't think the DBX is actually killing it.
But I think they've been selling more than other cars.
Like I say, I'm not sure that's been another one that's been hugely successful. I think the Brits love the DBX. It's probably better than the, what was it, one before it, the family hauler?
The Rapide.
That definitely flopped. And then another brand that I think is struggling with is Ferrari and the Parasegue. I don't think the Parasegue is selling on its own. I think people are buying it because they want to buy like the F80, right? The dealership and the brand makes you buy all these other cars in order to get to the supercars. So I'm not sure the Parasegue is actually a hit for Ferrari either. And they kind of try to take this weird route where they said, we're not building an SUV. We're building, you know, like a tall sedan or whatever, hatchback. But either way, I don't think it's actually working.
I think the problem is, I know as enthusiasts, we like to dump on these cars.
I'm not dumping on them. I'm just saying with Porsche, it was a runaway smash hit. And then everybody who copied it, except for Lamborghini. And I think the reason the Lamborghini works, the Urus works, is because the Urus is a family car that has that kind of Lamborghini DNA. And I know Audi Q8 basically is also an Urus underneath. Mm-hmm. I know a Porsche Cayenne is also, it's, you know, they all share the same parts, but the parts that do work on the Urus are the parts that make it the Lamborghini. So I think Lamborghini injected a lot of their DNA into it, and that's why it did so well.
At Ritual, we know what goes into the holiday season. The potluck planning, the gift giving, the spreadsheets. So this new year, take a moment for yourself with science-backed support that puts you first. So whether you're focusing on supporting foundational health with a clean vegan multivitamin or supporting your gut health with Symbiotic Plus, do it with 30% off your first month at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I would say, maybe sports car brand aside, SUVs always, almost always save enthusiast brands. Rolls-Royce, Cullinan's, runaway success. Mini was a small niche enthusiast brand. Countryman came, runaway success.
Have you seen the latest Countryman?
But they sell a lot of them. This is the problem with Mini is like, I know I hate the new Countryman, but they sell a ton of Countrymans. So whenever these like upper end brands or enthusiast brands come out with an SUV, all the enthusiasts hate it, but then they always sell.
Okay. All right. Let's keep going down the list. What else you got there? What number are we at?
Nissan Leaf is down 64.1%.
Yeah, and that is all to do with the fact that, first of all, they haven't updated the Leaf in like eons, and they didn't climate control the batteries. So early Leafs especially had bad range, and that range almost, you know, became null when they were in places like Arizona where the batteries got super hot.
5 Series Hybrid down 64.7%.
That one I don't know anything about.
The Maserati Ghibli, another high-end premium, this time a sedan, down 64.7%.
Yeah. That was also a FCA.
I would like to point out that the Ghibli in 5 years is an average of $70,000 lost, which is absolutely crazy.
Remember when we reviewed the Ghibli?
Yeah, it's fine. You can pick them up now for like under $20,000.
Remember we borrowed it from a dealer and He had like 13 on the lot, and he's like, go ahead, take it. And then we had the car for exactly 2 minutes before he called us, and he's like, we need the car back. There's somebody who wants to buy it. And I was like, don't you have 13 others? No, they want to buy this one.
Yeah.
That's kind of when we stopped working with dealers in terms of reviewing cars.
Number four is the Infiniti QX80, down 65%. And number three, the Tesla Model S, down 65.2%, or $52,000.
Yeah, I think that's the Lucid problem. People just don't want sedans.
Yes, and they also, the thing is, if you look at EVs on this list, electric vehicles lose the most value after purchase, falling on average 58% in 5 years. So EVs still do not hold the value.
And that's because of this. I'm holding up the phone right now, and I think the vast majority of people still think that EV batteries are like their phone batteries, and after 2 years, they'll be dead, even though we have been saying it, and the industry has been saying it, and tests have proved it. EV batteries are not phone batteries, and on average, EVs lose, at least Teslas, about 1% a year of their battery capacity, but yet in the mind of the public, EVs still are useless after 2 years.
A BMW 7 Series, down 67%, and...
Maybe I shouldn't be that harsh.
Yeah, that was a little harsh.
Okay, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have been that harsh. I think there is also a lot to be said where people understand that with EVs, they're buying the current technology, and the technology is moving so far and so quickly that why would you want to spend, you know, a lot of money on some tech that's going to be obsolete or out of date, you know, when you come off the lease?
Jaguar I-Pace, another EV. It's the highest depreciating car in 5 years, down 72% in 5 years. That's an average dollar of nearly 52 grand. I-Pace is a car. It was actually really, really bold of Jaguar to launch that.
I took it off-road, dude. I was so impressed by that car.
They were really ahead of the curve, but it was too expensive. Then the Model X came out and kind of beat it in terms of every spec possible. And it was just a little too weird looking.
It had that cab forward design.
Yeah, a little too low to the ground. And I just think people were very confused about what it is. Well, it was this the I-Pace on the website right now, Cole? Can you screen record this? Or is it on? Look at this. There's not a single picture of the car. What in the heck?
Oh, there it is.
Just show us the car. What, there's a room. There's a woman walking up some stairs. What is happening here?
There's a car turning its lights on.
Look at that. There's a tight shot of some trim. This is unbelievable.
Look, the I-Pace was a car that was just too early for its time. I think that the cab forward design...
Still haven't... There it is.
Didn't really work with people.
It was also too expensive.
The range was not enough for... I mean, the initial range, I think, was like 220 miles, which was not enough, like you said, for the $70,000 cost of entry. And you would think that Waymo would have saved it, right? Because every Waymo is now an I-Pace.
I'm not sure that's helped their...
You don't think that helps?
Their case, though. I don't know a lot of people that want to be driving around in what's known as a taxi, essentially.
But basically, if you get in a Waymo, then you know what an I-Pace looks like.
So, this
they
is...
Still, do they still sell them? I think they still... They haven't
stopped. Just discontinued it.
Yeah? Okay, they just... Yeah.
They, like, very recently. But, so, which
and,
of these...
And the dealers never marked them down. I remember thinking to myself, this car depreciates like crazy. I'm going to go buy one. We're going to have some fun with it. And the dealers were still asking, like... what I considered, you know, 20, 30% over what the current value of the vehicle was.
So which of these cars have we owned?
Well, we didn't own the I-Pace.
Nope.
We didn't own the 7 Series.
Nope.
Did we talk about the 7 Series?
Yep.
The reason the 7 Series, I think, depreciates so much is because if you're going to be in that luxury sedan category, the S-Class kind of owns it in some ways. And BMW has always been trying to work its way up to that, but... BMW's always been known more for their sportiness than their luxury.
But hold on there. That whole category depreciates like rocks. In the top 25 most depreciating, the A7, the S-Class, the A8 are all on that list. So they just don't hold their value, that class. So we've owned a Model S. We currently own a Model S.
Yes.
We've owned a 5 Series, not the hybrid, but a normal 5 Series.
We own a Leaf right now?
We own a Leaf. We've owned a Model X, and we've owned an Escalade.
Yes.
So we've owned five of the most appreciating and least appreciating cars.
What are we going to do when we run out of cars that we haven't owned?
Well, I think we're a while from there.
By that point, I'll be like, what? I'll be like, you know, in my 70s, and we'll start again. You can go back in your 50s and start all over again.
So other highlights on this list, the top 25 most appreciating, Taycans lose a ton of value.
Yeah.
60% in 5 years, which is really bad.
Cayennes lose a lot of value, too.
Discoveries are on this list, 60.9% Land Rover. Range Rover's on this list, 62%.
By the way, I'm trying to buy a Land Rover Discovery 2018 or younger. I guess 2017 be okay. The Land Rover Discovery 5, we would prefer the TD, turbo diesel, six. We would prefer if the timing belt had been changed, because that's a $4,000 job, Tommy. That's one of the reasons maybe they depreciate. Mm-hmm. But we want to, we think because they're so depreciated, we could turn it into a fun off-roader and kind of an unappreciated off-roader. So we're looking at buying one. Can't be black.
Are you hoping that someone's going to sell us theirs?
Yeah, I'm hoping that if you have one, that you'll consider selling it to us. We're looking at one that's probably in the $20,000 range.
Yeah, I'm not that excited about this car. Yeah,
Tommy thinks we're not going to get any views on it, because traditionally the Discovery has always been the least appreciated Land Rover, and that's why I'm kind of fascinated by it.
Well, hold on there, sport.
Okay. All right, gung it in.
It's not. I love Discoveries. Yeah. I own a Discovery.
Yes. You own a 3.
That's still a Discovery. It's a Discovery. It's a Discovery 3.
It's an LR3.
It's a Discovery 3.
It says LR3 on it, doesn't it?
Because Discovery name was so tarnished by the Discovery 2 that they had to change the name of it. The problem is that Discovery 5. LR3s, LR4s are all appreciated.
It looks like a suppository.
Yes, Discovery 5s are not appreciated because they're ugly. That's the problem.
People hate that like off-center rear license plate on them.
Yeah, they're just not cool looking. Like the LR4, this is a crazy, crazy bit of trivia. The LR4 ended production in 2016, okay? Yeah. They are more valuable than the Discovery 5 that replaced it. That's how much people like the design of the 4 over the 5.
Dare I say it, Tommy, we single-handedly took the Touareg from obscurity. Kind of
I wouldn't say single-handedly.
I will say single-handedly.
No, not single-handedly. There's a lot of companies that started
making
cars.
I sound like Doug, don't I?
You do.
We took that car from oblivion and turned it into the go-to off-roader when we owned our Touareg, or do you say Touareg? So I want to do the same thing for the Disco 5. I want to take a car that most people consider, you know, something that they haul their kids to school, slap some big old all-terrain tires. And by the way, we have those all-terrains.
Yeah, but they're on the wrong wheels. They're on 20-inch wheels.
Well, then you know, get the...
You're like, big old all-terrains. We put some rubber bands on it.
Well, we get the air suspension then.
What do you mean?
You get the one with air suspension, right? The Disco has air suspension.
The problem is not the suspension. It's the wheels too big and the tires too small.
Well, the wheels too big and the tires, you can lift up the vehicle.
No, that's not going to help you with a pinch flat, as we all know too well with our Defender.
But anyway, I want to take this... I want to turn it into, and if you have that orange one, the hero color that when it first came out, that's the color to get.
People know the Discovery 5 is capable. They're just deliberately.
I bet you they don't.
They do. They just deliberately ignore it because it's hideous.
There are two. There's one parked every on the walk that I take the dog, and I've talked to the owners and I've asked them. I've said, have you ever taken this off-road? And they looked at me like I fell from Mars.
Because, yeah, nobody takes their Discovery.
Look at that color. Isn't that color cool?
It's fine.
Oh, gee.
Dad, it's just not a good design. It's too round. It doesn't look like a Discovery. It looks like an LR4 got stuck in a wind chamber and its face melted. It just got all swept back and it just doesn't work.
All right. Well, if you have one and you want to sell it, info@tflcar.com. Mm-hmm. Shoot us an email.
Yeah. You're right that they do have all the off-road chops of an LR4.
They have air suspension. They have the selectable terrain management. Sure. Some even... come with the, I think it's called Capability Package Plus, which gives you a locking rear diff.
The other problem is most of these don't have the low range. Land Rover knows that nobody's taking these off-road, so they got rid of the low range.
Yeah, they actually do have low range. The ones I've been, unlike...
The early ones do, but if you look at the newer ones...
We can't afford a newer one.
Yeah, but they lost the low range. And even the early ones, it's kind of a rare thing.
It's not, actually. I've been looking at a lot of them. Most of the early ones have the low range. Mm. Unlike the... Remember, I was looking for a Range Rover. Very few of them had the low range. With these cars, most of them, at least the ones I'm looking at, 2017 was the first year of the LR5, I guess, or Disco 5. Those have a lot of them, at least the one. Maybe in Colorado. Maybe a lot of the low-range cars were sent to Colorado. I don't know. You know, we have mountains.
All right. So we have to talk about how we got scammed.
Oh.
This is pretty wild. So we got an invite to a podcast.
The Chelsea Handler podcast.
Which
seemed odd. And the invite was... very realistic. It had a picture of Chelsea. It came from the right email.
So, and I'll, Cole, maybe what I'll do is I can send you a link to this. It's pretty.
You want to just send him an email?
Yeah, I can just forward you this chain here.
But maybe you can't get the email on that computer.
Okay. Well, we'll include it then. But pretty wild, because at the bottom of this image was this guy's name. It has the email is dearchelseacollabs@gmail.com. It has quotes from Chelsea. It's got the picture of her. I mean, it seems like a real email. And then the other crazy thing, basically this guy said, hope you're doing well. I'm reaching out on behalf of Dear Chelsea, Chelsea Handler's podcast, with an amazing co-host, Catherine Law. We've been having a blast blending humor. And then she said, this person said, we're talking about a 50-minute to 1-hour live experience on Facebook, Instagram. They want to talk about our passion for the automotive world, all this stuff. So we followed up. We said, yep, that sounds good, because it looks so real, right?
Yeah.
And then the crazier part is this person who claims to be Lucas actually set up a video call with our producer,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And they talked about what things we were going to talk about on the podcast. We had a whole plan, which was pretty wild. We actually had a whole outline that they put together for what we're going to talk about. They sent us some dates that she could do it at, and it was going to be over Facebook events, right?
Yeah.
Well, what we figured out is that this is a Facebook phishing scam, okay? So this is a way for scammers to essentially get access to your Facebook page through these paid live events is the only thing we can figure out.
So this email was very good, because when we got it, I checked the email address that it came from supposedly, and it's the email address that is publicly exhibited on the Chelsea Handler show.
So the weird thing is, this is where it got to be a little suspicious. Is these paid Facebook events, right, have been discontinued since 2023, which I just learned yesterday.
Well, what was weird was that we were supposed to be on her show, but their producer called us and said, we go live on Facebook. So in order for you to do that, you have to go into your Facebook settings. Uh-huh. And then he walked our producer through.
And changed some stuff.
How we allow basically the Chelsea Handler show to be able to be displayed on our Facebook page. But what really they did was they gained access to our Facebook page.
Yes.
And that's where the scam came in.
Yeah. And it was really, really crafty, because very, very rarely, if you're being scammed, do you actually talk to someone in person, right? Do they go through this much effort? And then even after they gained access, they still kept the ruse up, like, we're still trying to schedule this. Yeah. We're not going to use Facebook anymore. We're going to use StreamYard, right? All of these things. And then we got an email yesterday when we were supposed to go live saying, hey, she got a cold. She was able to do last night's show, but doctor's advice 24 hours.
Yeah, her throat is hurting her, so we'll have to reschedule. And of course, when that happened, that's when the red flags came out for real. And then we basically spent a day trying to figure out how to undo what they had done.
Right.
So that they didn't have access to our page, which we think we have done. But I think the scam is that they get access to your Facebook page, uh-huh, and then they put up content that either somehow requests money or is paid for by somebody else, so that they're doing advertising on your Facebook page, but they're making the money for it.
They're scamming other people from your Facebook page.
Or they're getting paid. We don't know what the end game is, but we do know that this is something that is a pretty standard phishing.
Here's the interesting thing, though.
Yeah.
Is when I started looking around for this, it is a scam that has existed.
Yes.
But it's a pretty small group of people, it looks like, that have had this experience.
Yes.
Because these scammers are targeting Facebook pages that have large number of followers.
Yes.
So like my personal Facebook page where I have 6 friends, right? They don't care. But like I went on Reddit and this guy said, my band, 87,000 Facebook followers, has been contacted by supposedly management from a TV host, very large following. They arrange a call to prepare for the event. Person says that they want you to go to your events, change your settings, this kind of thing, yada yada, right? He wants you to go to the business manager, do this. And then a couple of people responded saying this happened to me with also a large following. So it's unlikely to happen to the typical Facebook user, but wow, what I've never seen a scam that's good, where they actually call you, they walk you through it, you see the person, right? I mean, it's a really good scam.
Yeah, it's weird. We should have been smarter.
Well, yeah. Why does Chelsea Handler want to talk to us?
Us two dorks on her show.
That is insane. Yeah, that is truly absurd.
When we told my wife, she said that she was just listening to her podcast and she had some kind of menopause expert on it. And I'm like, that makes sense.
So
why would you have two dorks from TFL Car?
Unlikely that she would actually want to do stuff. But it looks so real. And the email was dearchelseacollabs@gmail.com. I mean, oh gosh, I can't believe that we fell for that.
Yeah.
And we feel pretty dumb about it, but that's how we got scammed. So if you guys see anything suspicious come from our Facebook page,
yeah,
like any weird messages or events that are created, but tell me, like send us a message or send us an email.
Well, I should have been clued in when her producer called us and his name is what? Lucas what? What is it?
Lucas Morgan.
And then the guy has an Indian, not American Indian, but like an Indian accent, which was also weird. I don't think that people in India are commonly called Lucas.
So the whole thing is weird. Yeah. Luckily, I think we were able to catch it before anything bad happens. But
if you see something on our Facebook page.
Yeah, please send us an email.
Yeah, shoot us an email. Be our eyes and ears. We're watching it, but you know, it was not.
Pretty alarming. Yeah. I got to say, I was pretty alarmed by that whole situation. Yeah, it was very unpleasant, and trying to undo it has been a mess. So that's one of the things I want to talk about today. I'm going to flip our timer here.
Okay.
So I recently did a couple videos on the new Forerunner, new Forerunner.
Yes.
And
I took it in the snow this weekend.
Yes. How did it do?
You know, it's a tire thing, Tommy. So it's hard to separate the car from the tires, right? I think the four-wheel drive system, and it is a four-wheel drive system. It's not an all-wheel drive system because you got to select four high, which is also kind of weird. I think that's one of the ways they separate the Land Cruiser from the 4Runner, is that the Land Cruiser is all-wheel drive, whereas the 4Runner is four-wheel drive. It's fine, but it comes with Falcon's Wild Peaks, and we have done some tire testing, and these are not snow-rated, and I could tell.
Yeah, it's all down to tires, 100%. Yeah, it all comes down to tires. But the reason I brought it up is I just did a video on Tiffle Car after a month with the new Forerunner. Is this the best or worst Forerunner yet? And I genuinely do like the car quite a bit.
I like the car. It's bigger. It's more comfortable. It's more fuel efficient. I think it's actually better looking than the old one. And I think Toyota has addressed a lot of the issues with the old one, especially the fact that it had a 5-speed transmission, which gave it bad fuel economy. And yet people seem to hate it.
Yeah, people are really upset about the 4Runner, the new 6th generation. It's like this guy says, not a 6th generation 4Runner. Hater, so he's not a hater.
He's not a hater, but...
But it's cheaper as a small displacement turbo. The prices have gone up. The 5th gen 4Runners are going up and will be greatly missed. So and I think there are some valid complaints about this 4Runner. Like I talked about in my long-term update.
Yeah, what are the valid complaints?
Well, I mean, the rear seat's a little bit cramped. I think the interior is a little...
It's got more room than the old one.
Yeah.
2 more inches, according to Toyota.
Yeah, but it's still a little cramped.
Okay.
The fuel economy is better.
Yes.
But still not excellent for...
Low 20s.
Yeah, for the small displacement engine. I think the interior materials are a little cheap.
I'll give you that.
And I think that the ride quality is a little too choppy.
It is choppy, off-road. Yeah. But that could be because we have the TRD Pro.
Off-road.
Off-road, sorry.
So those are my big complaints, right? Yeah. But as a final product, right, as a consumer device... The new turbo engine is so much better drivability-wise from an everyday standpoint than the 4-liter V6. The torque delivery, the power, the passing power, the ease at which that engine can propel this vehicle down the road is, in my opinion, not like slightly better, but it's night and day.
Look, it's the same powertrain out of the Tacoma, right?
Well, and it's also in the RX Lexus and the NX Lexus. It's in the Highlander now. It's in a lot of products.
Yeah, I think it's also in the Crown. Is it in the Crown?
It's in the Crown, yeah, the Turbo, yeah. Great point. So, look, this engine is kind of becoming a universal Toyota engine, which tells you a couple of things. A, it fits a lot of different platforms. And B, it's probably been pretty sorted. Because Toyota wouldn't put that engine in all of these different products if it was going to have longevity issues.
Yeah, I kind of feel like we got the same criticism in the Tacoma. And today, the Tacoma is still selling like it used to sell. Mm-hmm. And it's still the number one midsize truck in the country. And so there's been a lot of like, it's like a tempest in a teapot would be the best way to say it, right? A lot of people are all up in arms about it. And yet, when you look at sales and when you look at longevity and reliability, people still believe that the 4Runner and the Tacoma are kind of best in class when it comes to those things. Let me ask you this question, all right? From a pure reliability standpoint, now we've owned all three of these cars. I'm not talking about off-road ability or comfort or anything else, just reliability and perhaps most importantly, residual value, right? Because that's why Toyota is able to price their vehicles so high because the residuals are so high. So if I gave you a choice, mm-hmm. and those were the only criteria, Would you buy a Wrangler, a Bronco, or a 4Runner?
For strictly reliability?
Yeah.
Still Toyota.
Yeah.
I mean, I still think that that brand carries a lot of weight in terms of longevity.
And I think that trumps pretty much everything for a lot of people.
Yes, it does. And I understand the concerns.
And that was not a political statement, by the way.
I understand the concerns to move away from the V6.
Yeah.
But guys, it had to go away. It was so old. And I know people are going to say, but it was reliable. But realistically, the people that say it's reliable are also the people that trade in their cars statistically every 5 to 9 years, right? If you are planning on buying one car and holding onto it for 35 years, sure, I'd get the V6 one. But people get bored. People change. They want something new. They might hold onto the car 80, 90, 100,000 miles, but very few people are holding onto a 250.
But don't you think as car enthusiasts, we do a great job of fooling ourselves into thinking this is the last car I'll ever buy?
Yes, and I do that every time I buy a car.
Every time you buy a car, you're like, this is it. It's worth buying. And then, you know, a few years down the road, there's a new, more, I don't know, quicker, sexier, fuel-efficient vehicle that comes along, and then you start kind of looking at it, and you start thinking, well, maybe I need something, you know, newer, better,
for sure,
faster, quicker, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, for those people that are complaining they want the V6 back for reliability, you're benefiting the fifth owner. That fifth owner is going to love you for wanting that V6. But as if you're shopping for a new one, statistically, people don't keep that car that long. And the other thing I'd like to point out, this engine has been around not 280 years like the V6 was, but, you know, it's been around a good number of years, and they sold hundreds of thousands of units in the Highlander, in the RX, in the NX. And if there were going to be major issues in the short term or even in the medium term, we would have learned about those issues in those products, right? And we're not seeing that. And then the bigger thing, which is just such a big deal, is the new 8-speed is light years ahead of the 5-speed. The 5-speed, and part of it is we do live in Colorado, which puts extra strain on the powertrain with the lack of air density. But that 5-speed was just miserable to road trip in the mountains, even stock, let alone lifted. It was just constantly hunting and searching, and it was never in the right gear, and the engine was screaming, and it was frustrating. I remember Case being like, what the hell is wrong with this 4Runner? And I'm like, nothing's wrong with this 4Runner, Case. It's just a very 1990s experience. Whereas the new one, it'll pick a gear, it'll build boost, and it will hold that gear throughout the grade. So it's just, it's such a better product. In my opinion, interiors are cheap, a little cheap, and the price is too high, but the price of everything is too high. And if that IC cars list is to be believed, and we don't know on this new generation, but hopefully the resale is also going to be impressive on this car, right? Because of the Toyota brand cachet that comes with it.
Nice. All right. I think we should move on, Tommy.
Okay, sounds good.
And this is a little bit of news that came out this week, and I wanted to talk about it because I've kind of lived it. And so it's a little inside baseball, but it's also a little bit behind the scenes. So I kind of wanted to share some stuff with you, having been in the business for, 15 years. But recently, our friends at
Motor Authority.
Yeah, thanks. Motor Authority just announced that they're closing the doors.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a bunch of good buddies that work there. I'm kind of feel like the automotive media is changing and not for the better.
Well, unfortunately, it was a lot of It was a lot of really popular websites that closed their doors that were connected. It was the Car Connection, Motor Authority, and Green Car Reports, which have been around for well over a decade at this point. So really sad to see our colleagues there be displaced out of a job because they did some really good writing.
Sorry, Rob.
Yeah, some really good content. Joel and Marty Padgett, too, was there.
Yeah, I mean, these are traditional
John Volker and
automotive journalists, right?
My buddy Edelstein, yeah.
And when I was a kid, there were basically three and then four buff books that if you love cars that you read, Car and Driver, Motor Trend, Road and Track, and then Automobile Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this, like, saying called the rule of 24. So if you wanted to get into automotive journalism, one of the easiest way to do it was to become an intern at one of these buff books. And the rule of 24 was that you were 24 years old, you made $24,000 a year, you worked 24 hours a day, and you lasted 24 months. and that was, in a way, I mean, it's funny, but it was the reality. And then, of course, the internet came along and basically made automotive journalism open to anybody. Right, all you need to do is either have a blog or have a website or start a YouTube channel. So it kind of democratized the ability for people to put their views or, you know, put their love of cars so other people could see it. And initially, I think that was a good thing, citizen journalism. But what ended up, I think, happening was that citizen journalism slowly turned into influencing. And in a traditional journalism model, influencing is just advertising. And now we're living in this world where it's hard to tell the advertising from the editorial. In other words, it's hard to tell what is real critique, what are real reviews, and what are paid for ads.
Yeah.
And I think that's not good for the consumer because it just leaves you guys thinking, is this person real? Is this a real opinion, or did somebody cut him a big fat check? And we always see that in our comments, right?
Sure. Well,
that's one of the most popular comments we get. You know, how much did Ford pay you? And the answer is nothing.
Yes. But it also worth noting that, you know, online you're supposed to have a content disclosure, right?
Yeah, I get that.
Which says, hey, this is sponsored content. Not that everybody does, or not even that maybe a large percent of people do, but it's something that is a way to try to differentiate paid versus not paid content. The problem was that I think that era of the buff books is coming to an end, and it has a long time ago, because you had a large pool of advertising that would really go to three outlets, right? And that large pool maybe has gotten a little bigger, but now there's 2,000 content creators that money can be spread across, right? And oh, by the way, back in the old subscription days, people would pay you every month for your content, which is not the case anymore. It's getting harder and harder to keep the company afloat just based solely on YouTube revenue, right? Which is why
it's happening to us, yeah.
Yeah, which is why we do have to sell ads, and we've got some great partners like O'Sullivan Law on Onyx, which allows us to still stay as unbiased as
and
we can.
Way safe,
yeah. Unbiased as we can to review a truck without being paid by Ford to review the truck, right? And stay in business.
Yeah, and let's make this clear. We don't take any money from the manufacturers. We don't get paid by manufacturers because I'm kind of old school. I'm like, how do you review something if you're getting paid to review it? That just seems like a blatant conflict of interest.
The problem is, and this has always been the conflict that we've faced and you know, in our industry has been facing us for years, is while we're not paid by the manufacturers, they still hold the keys to the kingdom, right?
Yeah.
So when we go on these press trips to go check out a new F-150, right? Ford covers the travel expenses. They put you up in a nice hotel. They pay for your meal. And certainly that could have an influence on the editorial. Now, what you used to be able to do in the world of really high budget editorial is you used to be able to pay that manufacturer back and pay for your own flights and your own hotels. The problem there is,
I believe Cars.com used to do that. I think New York Times
did that too, right? Yeah. And they couldn't accept any gifts, and that was great. I had a ton of respect for people. But if we did that, we would be out of business in like a month and a half.
Because we wouldn't get access to the cars.
Well, no, because we can't afford to pay them back on these. The revenue just doesn't offset the travel expenses. No.
And we wouldn't be able to get access to the cars early.
And that's the other thing is I'd like to say, no, please send us a car without the travel and without the hotel. But they don't do that early, right? They do that a couple months later. And by that point, a lot of that story has already been done by 25 other different outlets, and the shine has worn off that apple. And then we're at a huge competitive disadvantage, and then we go out of business because we can't compete.
Yeah, and then I think at the end, the car buyer, consumer suffers because then it ends up being a lot more advertising, let's call it influencing, than it does actual real editorial. And like you look at what's happened to those four buff books. So Motor Trend is kind of a mere shadow of itself. Basically, it was sold, and eventually Discovery bought it because they wanted the video content. Well, so they wanted Roadkill.
And to their credit, I think they still have a lot of really talented people there.
No, I'm not saying they don't, but compared to what Peterson Publishing was, that's what I'm talking about.
Original.
So once upon a time, Motor Trend was part of this vast publishing empire that included things like Peterson's Guns and Ammo and Hot Rod Magazine, and they were like 50 Mustang magazines, and there was Off-Roader, and there was Four Wheeler. All that is gone. Mm-hmm. All those magazines have closed their doors. And really, what you have left is, you know, a kind of, like I said, a shadow of what it used to be. Same thing with Road and Track. Actually, Motor Trend, I believe, was recently purchased by Hearst, which also owns Car and Driver.
And Road and Track.
And Road and Track. So it's been consolidated under Hearst. And I think the thing that makes Hearst money isn't any of that. It's the fact that they bought several years ago Bring a Trailer.
Sure.
So I think not even making money using editorial is making money for these big publications, and really, you know, the goose that laid the golden egg for Hearst, it seems like, is Bring a Trailer. It's auction sites.
Right. And there, Hearst also owns a huge number of other magazines. It's not just
right, yeah.
They have an enormous umbrella of magazines, right? Yeah. But no, it's a really tough time right now, and it's definitely getting harder.
And I don't want to be like moaning and whinging.
No, because it's an amazing job. It's a dream job, but it's also tough with the advent of short form content, which we've been very lucky that we're on, right? And gets crazy numbers, and we're so grateful that so many people watch it. But
it doesn't pay. It
doesn't make any money
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
And like a lot of the short form content,
and you have to do it. So it's kind of the cost of doing business.
Yes.
If you want to be in the game, if you want to be in the car review game, you got to create short form content, even though it's not generating, or it is generating, you know, a tiny percentage of what the long form stuff does.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And then you know, there's so much of that car review pie that's been cut up to so many different like slices now. When we first started this back in the day, it was like us and Matt was around, The Smoking Tire.
Saab Kyle
was around, obviously Motor Trend with Roadkill.
The Drive was really around. This was like 2010.
Yeah. And now, you know, anybody with an iPhone and a new car is reviewing it.
Yeah, and doing good jobs too.
Yeah, I'm not
right?
saying it's bad.
People are doing really good jobs.
I'm just saying at some point, the slice of our pie keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Well, the tough thing that we tried to do, which, you know, was I think both a really cool thing and put us at a bit of a disadvantage, is we have like a team of people. So, you know, Doug is really successful at what he does, but he is Doug, right?
Yeah, most YouTube channels, especially the big ones like Mr. Beast, are based on one personality.
And Doug brings in other people, but it's primarily mostly Doug, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with Engineering Explained, right? Jason, right? Super talented.
Hoovy,
right?
Yeah, all of them.
What we do, which is a little different, is like
it
could be me on camera, it could be Case, it could be you, it could be Andre, it could be Jen, it could be Mary, right? It could be Nathan. Yeah, we have a big team over a bunch of channels. So that makes it a little difficult from a YouTube standpoint, that the algorithm really rewards, in my opinion, having that same personality every time. Right. But we're still cranking along. We're still kicking in there. We're still not being paid by the car companies. And you know, people say that we're soft on them sometimes. Guys, if you knew the background and the number of car companies that we piss off on a regular basis, and have
I kind of feel if you haven't pissed off a car company, you're probably not doing a good job.
We've had some very uncomfortable conversations on like a monthly basis
with
some car companies.
We're still blacklisted by Subaru, so.
Yeah, and we've been short blacklisted by other companies and then unbanned and then banned and then unbanned. So like we have a history here, but that's just kind of the relationship you have to battle. And it's an opportunity as well. So that's our story with what's going on in the automotive space right now.
All right, let's talk about, before we wrap this up, let's do a quick fleet update and talk about some of the cars that we've bought.
Well, hang on.
You got some more.
I got some more.
Okay.
If you do want to support the team, which we're very grateful for,
yeah.
You don't have to, but head over to patreon.com/TFLcar. That's the place to do that. You can send us questions. We have early access to videos, and we actually respond to every message we get. So we'd love to hear your feedback. And I also want to start doing this. You know, if you do have questions you want asked on the air, send us a message, right? And we'll be sure to ask them. So Ryan asked us a couple of weeks back, 2026 Land Cruiser, the FJ. Have you seen this thing coming out, this little FJ? He linked to a Car Scoops article that says FJ off-road expected to debut this fall with body on frame. Any knowledge on that? Have you heard anything about the new small FJ getting body on frame?
All I've heard is what Toyota has announced, which was like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, right? They did this big announcement, Akio, where he rolled out all of these new Toyotas. And the only one that we've seen of those is a 4Runner Tacoma, but we haven't yet actually seen the new tiny FJ. And look, there's a lot of people, especially with AI now, who are creating content based on generating clicks versus actually, you know, talking about what's really happening in the industry. And usually, if there's a significant car coming, we will hear about it, and it won't be from some, you know, funky website or YouTube channel with an AI program. It'll come from people having seen the vehicle out there being prototype tested, or it'll come from the manufacturers where we've got, you know, background information. So I don't necessarily hold a lot of sway with the stuff that's out there, because increasingly more and more of it is just,
although
just
that,
clickbait.
That was a real create. That was a real.
Yeah, yeah.
Car Scoops is a real deal.
I'm not saying that wasn't, but like I said, until, you know, that's one of the things that I'm, you know, I was a broadcast journalist. I was a newspaper reporter, right? You don't just throw stuff out there without having a source for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very old school in that. And if there's nothing to report, then we probably won't report it.
We do a lot.
I mean, it's all based on, but we try.
I have done that a lot.
But we've tried to do it based on truth and not on spec. You know,
sure.
We're not doing it because, hey, people love the El Camino, so let's generate a fake picture of the El Camino and speculate whether GM's going to build it, right? There's always some reason that we're doing it.
Sure, yeah. Matthew asked us a question. He just got some new 18-inch wheels with new Cooper Discoverer tires on them. What is your guys' experience with this tire, if you don't mind me asking? Yeah, pretty limited experience with the Cooper Discoverers, but from the vehicles I have owned that have had them on there, they're actually pretty good.
Yeah, we've had good luck with them.
Yeah, pretty strong. Snow performance is okay, but if you don't live in a snowy environment, I think just stick with them, see if you like them. And he has them on Rebel wheels. Actually, we had them on our Rebel, and they were pretty good. I was pretty pleased with them. The thing about all-terrain tires is, for the most part, there isn't a lot of variation in between the tire. I know people are really, really brand loyal. Like, you've got your Falcon people, you've got your BFG people, you've got your Cooper people, and your Nitto people, and whatever. And yes, there is some performance difference, but for the most part, that kind of tire testing is so subjective that whatever you have, it's probably going to be fine.
Hey, so can I keep going
before
we do more questions? I'm not a big fan of questions, because I kind of feel like we're answering one person's question, and if that's not something you're interested in, it's not exactly relevant to you. So I wanted to talk about the HD Truck Palooza that we've got going on right now at the office. So as you know, Ram came out with the new Cummins, and Andre, because he's a very hard worker, was able to line up the Ford that competes with it, the Super Duty. And of course, we purchased the Silverado. So we have all three heavy duty trucks. And if you've been watching our truck channel and our off-road channel, you know that we've been doing a lot of comparisons. But we've got some exciting news, Tommy, and that is we are going to be hiking all three of the new heavy duties,
mm-hmm,
and MPGing them with identical trailers, which sounds easy, but it's not.
Yeah, a lot of moving parts that go into it, 100%. And it's a big deal, right? We've got we've got a brand new Ram and a brand new Cummins, which doesn't happen that often. So we got to see how it stacks up to the Ford and to the Chevy. Also, we're going to try to do some fuel economy testing with those. We already have a drag race up over at TFL Truck on the YouTube channel. If you haven't seen that, it was kind of, it's just fun. It's not necessarily super scientific, but it's cool to see which one's the fastest.
Yeah. Because for all of you non-truck people, what happens with heavy duty truck is they pull torque. In other words, they have so much torque that if you were to floor them in first gear, you would just do a burnout down the entire length of the drag strip, and so they basically pull torque until there's enough traction that you can actually use the torque that's available.
Yep. So we've big week for Andre this week with truck testing, and it's cool because they're all kind of, they're not the same price, and they're not exactly the same trim, but they are all three off-road focused trucks. We got the Trail Boss, the Tremor, and the Rebel. So they're all on off-road tires. They all have the diesel engine options, and they're all very expensive, although some are more expensive than others.
And I've got some personal exciting news. I am going on a romantic vacation with my best friend, Steve. I'm just joking about that, but we are going to go drive down the coast of California. But get this, Mercedes has been kind enough to loan me the new G-Wagon.
Sweet.
The 550 with the six-cylinder.
Sweet.
And we're going to use it as a road trip vehicle. We're going to take it to Moab. So there'll be a lot of videos coming with the new G-Wagon. That is a vehicle that is near and dear to my heart. So I can't tell you how super excited I am to get behind the wheel of that and see what it's like. Because, of course, in America, many of the previous G-Wagons have been 8-cylinder,
mm-hmm,
and now they've got the first 6-cylinder. Of course, traditionally, G-Wagons have had diesels, 6-cylinders, 8-cylinders, all kinds of powertrain, but not here in America.
Yeah, for sure. Yep, and then I am off to L.A. to check out something I can't talk about,
okay,
which I'm excited about. That'll be pretty cool. And then the following week, I'm actually off to Korea, which will be really cool for a week to also talk about some stuff I can't talk about. But I'm really excited to go check out what Korea's like. That'll be really cool. And then in terms of vehicles coming in, we've got a TRD Pro Tacoma coming in tomorrow.
And we'll be comparing that to our long-term Ranger Raptor, of course.
We can talk about that, thank goodness.
Yeah.
We've got our Ford Model T versus Moab Adventure going
up this weekend. I can't wait to see that. So Tommy and Case.
We talked about it last podcast. Yeah. But we went to Moab, Utah and took our 1927 Model T out into the sticks, which was just one of the coolest things that we've done in a long time.
And I finally got to drive our 500,000-mile Mercedes-Benz wagon, and it's actually really good.
Yeah, pretty good, right?
I was like, we bought this thing, you know, kind of sight unseen at the donated car auction here in Denver, and we bought it because especially that generation, what's the generation? It's the W210? Yeah, has not known for quality.
No.
And so we wanted to see if a 540,000-mile Mercedes would hold up. And so I'm kind of super excited to actually go and drive it.
Yeah, it's a really cool car, which I think a lot of people are going to be excited about. So be sure to stay tuned for that.
Yep.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
You need to take it?
No, I don't need to take it.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, I think that's it for today's podcast.
Yep. Thank you for watching. All right, let me take it.
Okay. I'll finish up here.
You finish up, yeah.
Sorry, we're trying to... We got a lot going on at the office today. All right. Cool. So, Cole, it's just me and you, buddy. So, we have a cool video coming. Actually, it just came. Wednesday, we have our Car-ish podcast. Be sure to subscribe to those, by the way. I'm really proud of the work that we've done in those. So Car-ish over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, subscribe on YouTube. And a big thank you to everyone on Patreon for making this podcast possible. But as always, this has been Tommy, behind the camera Cole, and on the phone my dad. We'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.